minor tasks to perform, one of which is to survey a little more of the historical side of alchemy, this time by paralleling the rise of alchemical traditions in North Africa and its development among the Chinese. Chinese alchemy is quite different in spirit, methodology, from the European approach to this subject. And because of its comparative antiquity and the way in which it developed, we may have a clue to the obscure origin of European alchemy. We've already noted the great rise of the alchemistical symbolism with its extravagant use of emblematic devices and elaborate formulas, coincided with the rise of the other mystical schools in Europe, and should not be regarded as ancient, as is popularly supposed. Now in China, we find what may well be the building up of the pattern that finally led to the rise of European symbolical alchemy. In China, this mystical art is associated with the cult of Taoism. So we'll have to examine for a moment Chinese philosophy, where in China, alchemy stems directly from philosophy, a link which we do not have in the West. We're not sure of the relation of these groups. But from the study of the Chinese, we may well begin to re-evaluate our Western historical approach. Taoism, arising as the result of the teachings of the obscure Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu, passed through three distinct stages in its development. The first, the philosophical, the second, the transcendental, and the third, the theological. These periods are roughly divided into about 600 to 700 year periods. Each of these sections would thereby correspond to something resembling 600 years of development and systematic readaptation. In the first 600 years of Taoism, the sect was essentially philosophical and essentially a very high form of Eastern absolutism. Lao Tzu was not only a mystic, but a very profound theist in his interpretation of the essential principle of Tao, or universal being. Hardly had Lao Tzu passed on before his followers, disciples, and several other Chinese scholars who became distinguished in the descent system, began to expand and elaborate the essential principles which he had taught. This period of expansion resulted in several recensions of the basic texts of the Guru and terminated about the beginning of the Fifteenth Era, or shortly thereafter. During this first period, we have a parallel with the first period in Buddhist philosophy, which was essentially a powerful ethical agnosticism. But gradually, it became evident in popular usage that the abstract principles of pure philosophy did not have sufficient vitality for masses to result in any strong development of sects or groups. The pure philosophy was simply too deep for the average person and did not come close enough to his own living experience. Therefore, the gradual transition took place, in which a series of compromises by interpretation increased the romanticism of otherwise abstract mystical learning. So beginning around the 3rd century AD and continuing till the 5th, 7th century, Taoism passed through what we would call a transcendental or purely metaphysical period. And it was in this period that alchemy arose among the Chinese. And it arose among these Taoist monks and scholars and sages would begin to think as much in this manner concerning the essential teachings of the original master, the ancient master. If universal consciousness, which was the goal, was to be achieved by man, then there must be certain methods or means whereby this consciousness can be more closely associated with the human being. And the Taoists, taking the attitude based upon a very brief statement in the Tao Te Ching, came to the conclusion that Tao, or universal life agent, the universal principle, existed in everything, but was more abundant in some things than in others. Therefore, in order to increase Tao, or consciousness, or life being within the individual, he should gradually associate himself with those things in which this principle was most abundant. We come very close to the Paracelsian theory of union. The certain living things had a larger share of this essential energy than other things. We believe that in a different way on a scientific level today. We believe, for example, that certain foods contain more nutrition than others. And to the Chinese, nutrition, the essential element of nutrition, or basis of it, was Tao, or life. Therefore, if we are a little bit unhappy today over overly refined sugar and overly refined flour and various homogenized dairy products, because we doubt their vitamin or vitality content, so the Chinese in this early period were speculating as to the essential abundance or deprivation of nutriment or nutrition within the various elements of food and the various means of concentrating Tao within the body of the human being. So we began to speculate like this. What are the principal ways in which energy can come to the person and be distributed throughout his body and nature so that he may unfold or grow or come nearer to the full expression of his Tao content? And the Chinese came to several conclusions. They divided this field into three essential parts. The first they called breath. Now, the moment they began to talk about Tao and breath, they began to come very close to the yogic systems of India. They held in China that Tao was in the air, and therefore that to inhale was to accept Tao into yourself. This is the breath of life, or the living breath. Air in its eternal circulation was symbolical of the endless motion of the Tao principle in the universe. So the problem was to increase the intake of air, which they did by various disciplines. Also, through the development of esoteric arts, to use the will or the consciousness to distribute this air within the body so that it could be more rapidly brought into direct contact with vital organs, nerve centers, and brain centers. They started in, for example, with a formula like this, that the disciples should start in by inhaling and then counting his heartbeat before exhaling again. He could start by inhaling, holding his breath, and counting his heartbeat up to 100 every time he should exhale. By doing so, he would increase the duration of the energy principle from the air, which remained longer within him. Also, at the same time, it would gather more negative or useless material to be disposed of. In other words, the Chinese referred to this process as body cleansing through breath. They held that the sage, through practice over a period of years, could finally reach the point when he could hold the breath and count it to 1,000. Which would be quite a long time, probably 2 or 3 minutes. And also, during this period of time, would accomplish what they call body cleansing. Now, the second part of breath was the ground is absolute ruin. And you can estimate the parallel between, for instance, this Chinese policy and Western calisthenics. You can see a good Westerner get up in front of the window, open it up, beat on his chest, take a deep breath, and back to explode. But then the West is not subtle. But the Taoists were subtle. So he told them what to do. He said, before you do this breathing process, you should take a feather and suspend it on a very fine thread or hair about 6 inches in front of your face. And in the process of both inhaling and exhaling, you must not disturb the feather's motion. You mustn't cause it to sway or move. In other words, you must both inhale and exhale very quietly, without any sense of pressure. You must not hold the breath until you burst and it all comes out in one fell swoop and you blow the feather across the street. You have to do this all very rhythmically, very subtly. There must be no obvious breath. There must be no obvious exertion. It must be gradually to bring this process completely within the control of the will. And the breath moved so quietly, so silently, so subtly, that only those who were well acquainted with the system could even detect that you were breathing. Thus, breath becomes absolutely smooth, as the Chinese call it. And by so doing, you have less and less human interference with this motion or rhythm. So the breath was one way in which they thought to cleanse and transform the internal part of the body. Now, the second thing they recommended was, of course, diet. And in the case of diet, they had some very strange ideas. For example, the Chinese rejected all grain. Instead of wheat being the sack of life and all that type of thing, they rejected grains of all kinds, the five grains which they knew. They said that, the grains were detrimental to bowel. They insisted mostly upon fruit and green vegetables and foods that were exceedingly light. They felt that any weight of food within the body, even though this weight might be of a very solid and substantial nutritive quality, was too coarse, too mundane, to serve the purposes of Taoism. That the universal energy principle found in plants was most easily assimilable directly from a living plant that was uncooked, and that it was also assimilable from the plant itself, rather than from its fruit or seed. That was the stalk, the stem, the leaf, the flower even, was more abundant in Tao than the final consummation of this plant in its fruit or seed. Because in the process of transforming into its final fruit or seed, a transition occurred in the nature of Tao, and it was not so readily available to the body. Thus, the Chinese held that universal life could be quickly taken in to certain kinds, types of plants and plant life. And in their mystical speculations, they listed a number of food products which were exceptionally powerful in this element of Tao. Now, the third phase of their research dealt with what they called discipline. Having used breath as one means, having used food intake as a third, as a second, the third was the actual use of the mind and the consciousness itself to draw or collect Tao. We then come in again to a very mystical expression of their concept or doctrine. Not only did they use the attention of consciousness to draw this energy, but they then moved this consciousness throughout their own bodies, directing Tao and distributing it by a voluntary action of the will. But whether it was the food, or the breathing, or the consciousness, it all had to be very rhythmic, very subtle, with a minimum of action of any kind, a floating of life upon the surface of action. Never for a moment this tremendous intensity with which we associate activity in the West. Now, the purpose of these three disciplines was the achievement of the mystery of immortality. And this corresponds very largely with the Western alchemical concept of the elixir of life. This mysterious substance that if properly prepared, properly used, would prolong life indefinitely. The Chinese have an old character who lived, according to their records, probably around 1,000 years B.C., who is their equivalent to Methuselah. He's supposed to have lived 800 years. And he's supposed to have lived almost entirely on Tao. In other words, he was maintained by the invisible energy in the air. And these Chinese scholars were quite confident that by means of a complete adjustment of their own bodies, their minds, their emotions, their diet, their breath, their thoughts, a complete adjustment with Tao or universal life, that if they could become like immortality, they would be immortal. And there are many legends in their mystical writings concerning these wonderful sages and saints, like the old teachers of the Jade Mountains, who gained incredible longevity, simply nourished by Tao, or as they would have called it, by the elixir, or the magical agent, the mysterious power of the universal life principle. Even the Chinese used the term medicine, or substance, or elixir, to represent this Tao, or the free energy in space. Now this approaches Earth level principle, very close to European alchemy, except that yet we are not catching very many of the alchemical terms as we know them. The Chinese term for universal medicine is very similar to the alchemical. But we do not have the paraphernalia, we do not have the retorts and the bottles, we do not have the laboratory and the bellows, and we do not have the elaborate alchemical or chemical formula symbolism which we have in Europe. But the end to be attained is almost completely the same. Now, this was the first of their concepts in relation to alchemy, the possibility of the attainment of an eternal life, the medicine that heals all mortality, and when attained by the mystic, makes him immune to the evil in the world. Not only is he protected against sickness and age, but he is protected against the evils of any creature that might attempt to attack him or endanger him. He is indestructible because he is identical with Tao, because the interval between himself and universal life has been reduced to a minimum. So, years ago, when I was traveling in Korea, I went into the Diamond Mountain area, and there had the opportunity to contact a few elderly Taoist scholars. You can say, probably, that they belong to the same pattern as we find on beautiful old Chinese paintings of wonderful rugged mountains and waterfalls and old scholars seated under a tree. They did not have quite that amount of glamour, but from these men themselves and from legends and lore in the community, we could get a pretty good picture of how things were 1,000 or 1,500 years ago, because things are slow in those countries. It was a well-tested records in that region that many of these old scholars were about 100 years old, and in probability they were. And one look at them would well testify to extreme longevity. There were rumors that some of these 750. And while there was no particular point of the fact that they would ever be immortal, they certainly had exceeded the average person's span of life. They had extended usefulness. Most of them did not require any of the aids that we need in order to keep functioning even at 70 or 80 in our way of life. One of their principal concepts there was that the secret of longevity is the reduction of friction. And friction must always be the resistance of a personality to the law. In other words, Tao is reality. Those that move with reality flow as little ships upon the surface of the great and placid river. Those who go against the law immediately come into conflict. And the moment there is conflict, there is death. There is friction, the wearing out of things, the exhaustion of resources, the wasting of energy. It is not what we do that wastes energy, but the way that we do it. And also the hazards, mental and emotional, with which we burden the things we do. An individual in the West has an unpleasant task to perform. He worries about it for days before he does it. He He wishes he didn't have to do it. He tries to find some way of pushing it on someone else. And as the time becomes nearer and nearer, he becomes more and more sorry for himself because he is faced with this burden. By the time the actual task arrives, he is no longer really in good condition to face it. He has dissipated more energy in vain regrets over the circumstance than would require to solve it. Then after it is finally completed, he continues to be sorry for himself, and then develops a gradually a heroic attitude, in which he goes from then on recounting to others the extraordinary serenity and the extraordinary courage with which he faces the disagreeable situation. This is a tremendous waste of energy. And the valorist would simply advise that the person relax and pull through the circumstance, whatever it is. Face it. Face it without qualms, face it without regret, face it without fear. Whatever it is, it is. You do it as well as you can, working in a complete state of relaxation so that every faculty and power that you have is available. You are less likely to make mistakes. You are less likely to make a wrong decision or a hasty one or an over-imposed one. And in all probabilities, the incident itself will almost evaporate as it approaches because you have failed to make it important. By so doing, you have conserved energy and kept the law. Well, these old Chinese scholars say that the answer to all this is simply relax. That if you meet all incidents simply as factual, simply things to be done this, regardless of whether you like them or do not like them, you take all of the pressure out of them. You take all of the tension away from yourself. And as a result, you accomplish more. You enjoy better health, and no matter how busy your life may be, you have time to sit in your bamboo grove and write poetry. The Taoist monks who have watched Europeans in China and in other countries in their way of life point out that even the busiest man in the West could sit in his bamboo grove if he wanted to. If he only did the things that he is doing now, but did them with absolute lack of tension, he would find that instead of taking all day, it would take 2 or 3 hours, and he could write at least one extra poem every day. It depends on how we do things. And in Taoism, this smooth way, the quiet way, the peaceful way of doing everything is the way of immortality. It is also the best preventive we know for ulcers, one of the serious difficulties of our modern life. So all of this lies into one pattern, and that is the Taoist concept of the possibility that man, by special knowledge, by arts, by sciences, by the investigation of natural law, can finally achieve eternal life, which they regarded as not impossible, although they did not claim that they had attained it. They did claim that they had found ways of extending life, which would indicate that the ultimate goal could be accomplished if man's consciousness was brought into absolute harmony with the universal plan, so that full and complete union with reality would mean not only the end of sorrow, the end of pain, but the end of death. This was their belief. We may assume it or not assume it as we please. Now the second thing that was a great concern in China, and has always been a great concern in China, was poverty. In China, there is no middle class, as we know it, as it never has been. There is the rich, and there is the poor. And the poor are many, and the rich are few. And between these two, what we call our great white-collar class in the West has no existence. So in the second degree of the concept of art, magic, sorcery, metaphysics, the Chinese developed the idea that comes the closest to the Western alchemical tradition, and that is the transmutation of base metals. He believed firmly that it would be perfectly possible to make gold. Why? Because gold was a symbol of Tao. Gold, as the most precious of all substances, was an appropriate emblem of reality, the most precious of all things in space. As the gold represented the light of the sun, the light of reason, the light of wisdom, the light of truth, so gold represented the great treasure. although on the mystical and philosophical level could be wisdom, because wisdom is a kind of wealth that exceeds all the wealth of the earth. Truth is a treasure greater than the most precious diamond. Reality is more valuable than the scepter of the purest jade. So all these great and wonderful realities, these truths, this wisdom, all these became associated with the concept of gold. Now the gold, in turn, was associated with the concept of being the king or ruler of all the matters. So Shangti, imperial heaven, was the yellow emperor. And yellow was a color which, rising in the Taoist period of Chinese metaphysics, became the emblem of the yellow road of heaven. It became also the emblem of the imperial house. It was the sign of supreme power. And yellow and gold were religious. So the great gold, the Chinese, began to develop a concept. If a man should live forever, or would live forever, the practical Chinese would say, there's no use in living forever if he's going to be poor forever. You just can't do anything. You can't get anywhere on that philosophy. And if you think about the Chinese for a moment, you realize that with all their philosophy and all their art, they're very practical people. There isn't a person in the world shrewder than a Chinese merchant. So in China, of course, a well-fed person who shows a reasonable amount of rotundity is regarded as almost approaching a divine estate because there are so few of them. Therefore, one of their basic symbols for happiness in this world is to be fat. The fat person is happy. Because you cannot be fat without having something to eat. And in China, an individual who has something to eat is a superior man. He not only is most fortunate, but he must be most clever, or he wouldn't have found a way to become rich. The worldly wisdom, worldly power, worldly affluence, all has to do with food. And food, in turn, all has to do with money. So on the physical plane, the Chinese, being always a practical man, instead of doing what some of the Western religions have done, and that is develop methods of medicating for prosperity, decided to go into the transmutation of metals. And, believe it or not, way back in that period, the Chinese hit upon mercury as being the most important metal or element in connection with their transmuting process. And they associated mercury with a substance called cinnabar, from which mercury could be abstracted. And so cinnabar became the basic material with which they worked in the effort to gain the secret of the transmutation of metals. They had no laboratory such as we know, as we've mentioned, and your painting of an old Chinese alchemist, as he looks back in that period, usually represented a little man seated under a tree somewhere, with a very tiny little stone in front of him, probably about the size of a suitcase, and looking more like a moderate-sized incense burner than anything else. And in the stone, and in this little furnace he had, a little cup in which he was working all these materials, and he certainly was not in mass production. He was working in a very small space with a very small amount of something. But he was very busy and just as conscientious and absorbed in his activity as any Western chemist. But he didn't have a great number of materials. He didn't have a wonderful pharmacopoeia to call upon, or shelves with bottles and all those things. He was more or less working with one little container, one little group of substances, which he probably carried in a little box in his sash or something of that nature. It was all done on a very personal and intimate scale. When he was looking for a means of transmuting base metal into gold, and he held that the reason he knew it could be done was because on the level of philosophy, his own base metals, his person, could be transformed. If he, as a person, could be transmuted from a state of ignorance to a state of wisdom, then on the level of the metals, base metals must be susceptible of changing. Man can change. Man can perform the alchemical mystery in his soul. A man which is possible to the soul, by analogy, is also possible to the body. So the Chinese alchemist was convinced that the rules and regulations by which he could achieve his own identity with Tao could be used to bring all base substance into an identity with Tao, which was Tao. It never occurred to him for a moment to question that this rule of analogy was essentially correct. Now, as we have in the West a great many accounts of transmutation, so we also have in the East. And there are many old Taoist hermits who are supposed to have been able to go on indefinitely, performing great and wonderful charities by means of the gold which they were able to manufacture. Now, there was another element that came in connection with this. And perhaps this had a bearing on it, although we're not too sure of all the elements involved. Unfortunately, we had as much knowledge of Chinese literature as we have of Roman. It would probably have changed across the Western civilization, but we don't have it. In the Taoist work, the problem of the production of medicines under magical formulas for the curing of various diseases developed very rapidly. The Chinese had a strange and rather eccentric group of meditations, but they still were quite shrewd, quite wise, and quite gifted in their ability to treat many ailments for which we have no immediate solution. But in their medicines, one of the most important and priceless ingredients, particularly in their mystical remedies, was gold. Now, you know, as we all know, that it would probably have been very hard for Socrates to have gotten the gold if he had wanted to do any chemical experimentation. He probably never had the price of one small Greek gold coin, or at least very seldom that. Three old chemists working with various medications in China were monks. They were poor persons who had renounced worldliness, so called, to go into scholarship and study in meditation. Gold was for the emperor, not for the monks. Gold was not for an old hermit somewhere among the mountains, unless he happened to be fortunate enough to live in an area where he could maybe mine a little gold or have a little gold himself. For the most part, he had no contact with these elements. Therefore, to him, it was necessary to manufacture them. And there is a legend or tradition that the Taoists made gold for the purpose of their medicine, not for its own sake, but because they needed it as an ingredient in something else. Not being able to buy it, not being able to afford to get it, and not being likely to receive it as a gift, and under the economic conditions of China, they had to learn some way of making and manufacturing either gold or a synthetic material which had the same attributes. But in the course of their experimentations, they also manufactured synthetic stones. They manufactured synthetic jade and amber. They perfected a great many chemical formulas, as did European alchemists who gradually enriched the entire code of chemistry through their various researchers in related fields. So we have the second of the two desirable things. One is the elixir of life. The other is the transmutation of metals and the formation of synthetic stones, which is the equivalent of the philosopher's stone. So they were working on the same basic story, but they came about it a little differently. Taoism continued to exercise a comparatively powerful influence in China, especially in this metaphysical field, until about the 7th or 8th century, when it began to tangle with the newly rising strength of Buddhism. Buddhism had been introduced into southern China about the beginning of the Christian era. Some say slightly earlier, some say slightly later. But there probably was an impermanent foundation in the first or second century BC and a permanent foundation about the second century AD. So the Buddhism was coming in. And Buddhism was already also passing through a transition period. Buddhism moved into China about the time when it began to expand its own transcendental doctrines, moving from the philosophic foundations to its own metaphysical foundations. At this period, Buddhism came in with quite a different viewpoint from that which was in China at that time. Buddhism also brought a certain amount of alchemical and chemical speculation with it from India, where for a long time, scientific research had been more or less intensively carried on. A little later, however, after the rise of Nalanda and some of the great institutions in India, that Buddhist scholarship in art and in science, especially in chemistry, began to drift towards China and began to mingle its stream with the indigenous culture. Actually, there is not a great deal relating to what we call alchemy in the original Buddhistic philosophy. There is, however, a great deal about the philosophy itself, which is reminiscent of the original concepts of Tao and the Chinese belief in the possibility of man's final identity with an eternal state. But it was not in Buddhism so much an eternal life as it was an eternal consciousness in Nirvana. But in its transition from one part of the world to another, in the gradual rise of what is called the Northern School, or the Kala Chakra, Buddhism began to take on a great deal of transcendental culture. Until for the time it was centered in the Northern group, the rise of Lamaism in Tibet, and the rise of the Great Vehicle, and the Pure Land sect in China, there was a lot of speculation going on, a lot of metaphysics drifting into the Buddhist philosophy. Buddhism, much like Gnosticism and Neoplatonism, had an absorbing quality about it. And when Buddhism struck the alchemical tradition in China and in adjacent countries where this tradition was developing, it immediately accepted it and imposed it upon its own doctrine. So that there came to be an alchemical or alchemistical interpretation of Buddhism also. And this particular phase of the subject is still very largely taught in the colleges of the Arhat sect in Tibet. And these colleges, among their other magical rituals or magical studies, include the transmutation of metals, the development of a universal medicine, and the indefinite prolongation of life. Now, all of these ends, as they were developed for the Chinese, would be rather inconsistent with Buddhist philosophy. But when Buddhism moved into a strange area where other philosophies were already present, it became mingled with them in a kind of alchemy of its own. And as a result, there are many doctrines now to be found within the Northern Buddhist schools especially that have very little in common with the original teachings of Gautama. They represent the minglings of traditions from one school to another. Looking with this, going even into Japan, where Buddhism and other groups, and even Shinto, have some alchemical tradition, we gradually observe the Eastern group to be concerned with alchemy or chemistry almost entirely on the level of a means or a method for accomplishing one of the three great purposes of European alchemy. And the two we have mentioned, namely eternal life and wealth, has a third added in the course of time. And that third is the gift of vision. It was very important in these systems that the theophyte or the disciple should eat of the peach of eternal foresight. In other words, the power of immortality implied with it also a complete and eternal knowledge of all things happening everywhere, an ability to mentally announce the future, to examine into the deepest secrets of the world and of life. And therefore, there had to be some mysterious elixir of vision by which the entire mystery of life could be unfolded to the fortunate possessor of this wonderful substance.
There's another interesting phase of this in the Taoistic concept that also mingled later with Buddhism. And that is that somewhere in the mysterious hinterlands of things, there is a place where the genii, or the spirits, or the immortals dwell. There is a mysterious, fabulous land far beyond the reach of the average person. And here, the wonderful beings whom we see in little figures of porcelain and bronze and wood today were supposed to have an actual existence. They were the sages who had eaten of the future immortality and had gone off to join the city of the immortals, where the scholars and the mystics and the alchemists and the magicians all live together forever in eternal bliss. Somewhere beyond those mysterious mountains that encircle the great Middle Empire. So your would-be alchemist, your mystic to come, believe definitely in the intercession of those who had already achieved the mystic. Because when you have immortal life and eternal wisdom and all wealth, you were a kind of super being. You might come floating down out of the sky riding on the back of a plane, for example. Or you might step off of your familiar dragon in front of your house someday and explain to him all the secrets of life. These people definitely have the belief that there were spirits, and that these spirits possess these secrets. In Europe, you have the same thing, because you have elementalists. And Paracelsus even believed that you could capture and hold these elementaries or beings, that they could give you the secret of the stone and all these wonderful and mysterious powers that have to do with the control of the elements of nature. So we now have the sage, the perfect one, the mysterious elder who has the stone and who becomes the equivalent of the European adept. And the Taoist adepts are these wonderful, pleasant-faced old gentlemen with long beards and high foreheads. They're associated with wonderful creatures, dragons and griffins, and wonderful birds and beasts, with knotted staffs and crooked sticks in their hands, and carrying bottles, and carrying baskets, and carrying bags, in which all the paraphernalia and wonders of their knowledge, these would all conceal. Sometimes the genie would sit down on the bag and the bag would fill up his face with him. It was anything he wanted. It was magic. And in this second period of Taoism, everything was magic. And magic also could cause you to communicate with these beings. And these beings could take you to the city of the gods, and there they could teach you this mystery of the stone. They could give you the secrets and formulas that you had sought for so desperately and so patiently through the years. So this phase of the alchemical tradition in China parallels very closely after Europe. The beings in Europe were not quite so fantastic, but the essential principles were the same. That it was possible for you to receive instruction from a master of the art who had already achieved this. Because in alchemy, it's perfectly possible for you to share knowledge. You lose nothing by it, the other person gains. But his gain is not your loss. Therefore, there is no particular reason why you shouldn't help him. In China, then, we have all of this tradition building up and growing and developing, and it finally comes out to us after maybe 2,000 years in what we call today the Flower Age tradition. Whether in the Moribana school or the Ikinomo school in Japan, the arrangement of flowers, the tea ceremony, all of these things, the incense ceremony, all have to do with the same principles, the same rules, the same ideas that underlie the Taoist concept of attitude. So we'll take a little time to go into that, and we'll try to show you exactly what is intended. Now, we mentioned in the Western tradition the presence of three essential elements, which must be united or brought together in the mystery of the stone. In the West, they're called the king and the queen and mercury, or sulfur, salt, and mercury. Now, in the Chinese concept, the sulfur is called heaven, the salt is called earth, and the mercury is called man. And the great triad in Chinese philosophy, and it finally came into European thought also, is a triad of heaven, earth, and man. This triad goes through all of their art, all of their sculpturing, all of their painting, every phase of their cultivation. And the reason, for example, in showing this art, in Oriental art, that instead of having the wide margin of a picture at the bottom, as we have it, they have it at the top and a narrow margin at the bottom. When we frame a print, we always frame it with a longer margin below and a shorter margin above. We think it's more artistic that way. When we print book pages, we always leave more margin at the bottom of the page and less at the top. Whereas in the Orient, they do exactly the opposite, because the upper margin is always heaven, which must be superior, and the lower margin is always earth. And then between these is the work of art. And this is man, because man is the work of art. And art is skill perfecting nature. So heaven, earth, and man must always be represented. Heaven is above, earth is below, and the artist painted the picture in the middle. Therefore, he is man. And in this particular very interesting old mandala here, which is about 11th century, from the Nara period of Japan, you will find down here among the demons in the bottom of the picture is painting with the artist, a little portrait of the artist who did the picture. You can't see it. I am covering up the artist and all that. But sometimes. But the heaven, earth, and man is a blossom, a leaf, and a bud, and is the basis of all flowering, because it must all be triadic. Heaven, earth, and man is sulfur, salt, and mercury. So in producing all of their artworks, therefore, everything that they do is a formula. These formulas are so exact in Chinese art that it takes 500 years sometimes for one of these schools to permit a master to go to the extension of adding one more blossom to a suite of cherry flowers. There must be just so many. And it's a major division and major rise within a school if one more petal is added to a flower. Everything is so completely systematized and integrated under rules, complete canons and law. In Taoism, therefore, we have this over concept of Tao containing within itself, within its own eternity, heaven, earth, and man, which also returns to us in the Confucian doctrine, and of course returns again very definitely in the Buddhistic triad, where you have the three great principles. You have Amitabha, the great the Supreme Buddha, then you have Avalokiteshvara, and you have one of the three Bodhisattva. These are heaven, earth, and man again. They are spirit, body, and form. Now in this painting, spirit is above, probably represented by a Chinese phoenix. Below is matter. In the middle is form. And there you have form, a magnificent composition. Now form is your chemical combination. Form is your alchemy coming in. Because in this central part is a formula. And a formula is a pattern in form. You can almost sense the meaning of it from the word formula itself. A man is a formula. The stone is a formula. The human soul is a formula. And in the Oriental system of art, it is always taught that the picture, the representation, must always be an absolute synthesis of the formula. And the formula is always balance. The formula is always equilibrium. It is always synthesis. China, therefore, picked very quickly upon the three great systems that arose within its own country and created a triad out of Confucius, Laozi, and Buddha. And these were the three famous vinegar tasters of the old Chinese paintings. These three represented the schools, heaven, earth, and man again. And in this emphasis, you have the problem of equilibrium. And in alchemy, the great problem of equilibrium is the balance of the formula, or the balance of the compound. Because if you bring heaven and earth and man together in exactly the right compound, you have immortality. You have the stone. You have the universal medicine. You have the mystery of all knowledge. And you have complete equilibrium, which is the secret of Tao. If, therefore, the Chinese began to experiment with this concept, they believed that the great hermetic miracle was played or was taking place within the great glass bottle of the universe. And upon this bottle lay planted in Egypt the seal of Hermes, so that we refer to it now as the hermetically sealed bottle, meaning in this case that nothing can get in or out. But originally it merely meant that the bottle used in medicine and science were stamped with the mark of Hermes as a sign of the purpose of the experiment and also as a proper sign of medicine or the healing art. Within the great bottle of space, the universal or eternal experiment was taking place. This experiment was the generation between heaven and earth of man. Now this generation did not mean man just as a human being. Rather, in the Hindu sense of the word manas, meaning the mind or the soul. Actually, the great transmutation was the union of spirit and matter to produce the mystery of soul. A man, because in him, of all creatures visible and knowable to us, we have the only obvious example of soul. And because man is able only to examine himself firsthand and all other things secondhand, and because man cannot find soul in anything else because he can experience only himself, therefore, he became the symbol of the mystery. He became the symbol of the mysterious agent in which the compound of the opposites was achieved in the complete sublimation of universals. Man, therefore, receives from above by the Hermetic symbol of fire, by the Hermetic symbol of fire. He receives an influx or an internalization of spirit. From the earth beneath him, he receives the ascending influx of matter. Therefore, he has a body derived from the elements and a spirit derived from the stars, as Paracelsus said. And between the elements and the stars, between the earth and heaven, move the orbits of the sacred planets. And these are the seven metals from which the mystery of the soul is compounded. So man becomes the living soul. And as soul, there is achieved within him the equilibrium of spirit and matter. Now, to bring this equilibrium to bear upon the alchemical formula, the absolutely true center of the interval between spirit and matter must be found. And this is, again, revealed to on another level of symbolism, which is just as perfect and just as extraordinary, and about which someday I hope we'll be able to talk at greater length, and that is your music symbolism. The Pythagoras steps the monochord between the orbit of the fixed stars, or heaven, and the surface of the earth, or the elements. And he caused this cord to be marked along its way with frets, to break the cord, or to break the string of the one stringed instrument into the harmonic intervals. And he placed one fret in the exact center of the string, by means of which he secured the mystery of the octaves. And in so doing, he placed this fret in the position of the sun in relation to the solar system, the way the ancients studied it. So that he caused the absolute point of equilibrium of tone to correspond with the body of the sun. And he caused this in man to correspond with the spiritual nature of the heart. And this sun, therefore, we come to again in alchemy. And from the salt and sulfur, the opposites, mingling together, we have in spirit united to matter, the middle distance or meridian of form, the octave point on the thread or cord. And here we have the sun, which is the focal point of the world form, form being the perfect compound of spirit and matter. Now, as the sun occupies this mysterious central point, the sun is therefore gold, because the sun is produced alchemically in space by the mingling of the opposing elements. And all the great work of heaven and earth is achieved in the production of the sun, or gold, the core of the great world of metals. In this way, the philosophy of alchemy says that wherever there is absolute equilibrium, there is a sun, and that all planets and all other bodies are off balance. Wherever there is the sun, there is equilibrium. And the moment this equilibrium occurs, the sun becomes creative and causes to move from itself a series of unbalanced polarities and forms a solar system.